copyright forum of Christian leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
As you're approaching the Reformation, it's important to understand why it happened in the first place. And so what I want to do in this first talk is we're going to look at the trends that are taking place in Europe for about the century or so leading into the Reformation. Some of them will go back a little bit farther than that. Some of them will be a bit more recent. But that's the general idea of what we want to do here. In the early 1500s, the Catholic Church was in desperate need of reform. It was an institution that was literally in crisis at all levels. We can start at the local clergy. At the level of the your average parish priest, you're in a situation where the priests are largely untrained and are actually, in some cases, encouraged to do things that violate canon law. And the reason why this situation happened really has a lot to do with the Black Death. The bubonic plague and close cousins swept through Europe in 1348 and wiped out 48% of the population of the continent, according to our best, most recent estimates. It hit all social classes equally, except the clergy. And the clergy was actually killed in higher numbers, higher percentages than the general population. And the reason for this is that many of the priests were very serious about carrying out their duties, and they would go to minister to plague victims, and then they would contract the disease themselves and die from it. The priests that didn't die were typically the ones who kind of hightailed it to the hills, the ones who were maybe a little less serious about their vocation. But after the Black Death, this left the church in a situation where they were in desperate need of more priests. So they opened the doors to pretty much anyone who wanted to be ordained, with the effect that the overall level of the clergy declined dramatically in the decades after the plague. This led to a situation where, like I said, the priests lack education, first of all, very little in the way of training. It was not uncommon for priests in the late 1400s, beginning of the 1500s, not to know the Latin language, not to be able to read or write. They had simply learned the Mass by rote. They learned all the rituals by rote, sort of in an apprenticeship kind of capacity, and they ran through it. Now, according to Catholic doctrine, this works. It doesn't matter if you're a duly ordained and consecrated priest. If you say the Mass, the miracle happens, the sacrament is consecrated, and everything is fine, whether or not you understand what's going on. So, from the perspective of Catholic theology, this was good, but the problem is the priests were not in any kind of a position to help the laity, to educate them, to train them, to teach them, to catechize them, anything of the sort. So you have this massive problem of ignorance on the part of the priests. You also have a problem with concubinage, that is to say, priests who are sleeping with a woman they aren't married with. Now, the reason for that is quite simple. Marriage was illegal. Priests could not marry. But a lot of the priests didn't exactly have a vocation of celibacy, and they found this a situation that they couldn't really live with. And frankly, as we'll see later, the bishops encouraged them in this. So you have a high degree of immorality in the clergy as well, along with alcoholism and a whole series of other problems. Now, you would think at this point that the bishops, who are in charge of overseeing the local clergy, would do something about this. The problem is, they didn't. For the most part, the bishops were quite content to allow the situation to continue as it was. Because, you see, every year they would examine the local clergy. You'd have a thing called visitation, where they would send people around to do a survey of what's going on with the local priests, or they would call the priests in to the diocesan headquarters, and they'd examine all of them. And the priests that had concubines were told, you're violating canon law, you have to pay a fine. And when you look at the account books of these bishops, there is a regular item in their budget for fines from priests with concubines. So they would actually actively encourage the priests to have concubines. You just pay a fee and you can do this. Okay. this is the level of corruption that you're seeing there. There's no concern with oversight of the clergy at all. But the bishops are doing other things as well. Many of them, the ones who are particularly well connected, will actually be appointed bishop of more than one diocese. So they will actually have multiple dioceses that they're technically the bishops over. This is called plurality of office. And what they would then do is they'd appoint somebody to actually do the work, and that they would simply collect the money. Along with this, there's a related problem of non-residents. That is to say, you have bishops who don't live in the diocese in which they are working. Sometimes this is because, well, for example, the bishop of Geneva typically was not in Geneva because he was also an officer within the Holy Roman Empire. So he would spend his time at the royal court. In other cases, priests would live on family estates, particularly if you're, say, from southern France and you're appointed a priest in northern Germany, you're going to spend the winters at your estate in southern France. Things like this would happen pretty regularly because the bishops didn't take seriously their calling as ministers. For them, being a bishop, for the most part, was a matter of prestige, a matter of family connection, a matter of a good way to earn a living, but not necessarily a true spiritual calling. Okay, so you've got a problem with the bishops. Now, all the bishops have to be approved by the papacy. What's going on with the papacy? Why isn't the papacy doing something about this? Well, it turns out that the papacy itself was shot through with problems. So you can look, for example, my favorite example from the Renaissance is the Borgia papacy. Now, Borgias, we could do an entire session, actually more than one session, on the Borgias. This is a family that deserves an opera. They are so far over the top. Actually, I think there's now a mini-series on them. They are so far over the top, it's almost hard to believe. The first Borgia pope was Calixtus III. He was elected to the papacy in 1433. He was old and frail, and the fact is that the College of Cardinals had split over who they really wanted to be pope, so they elected him to be a caretaker. The idea being he's going to die real soon, so what will happen is we'll get him appointed as pope, and we can decide in the meantime who we really want in the office. Well, it turns out Calixtus surprised them with a burst of vitality, and he was pope for 25 years. During that time, he followed the traditional practice of nepotism, appointing typically nephews, that's where the word comes from, to key positions in the church. Except in his case, he did it on a truly grand scale. His nepotism extended literally down to the cooks in the papal kitchens. One of the people that he appointed as a cardinal was an underage nephew of his named Rodrigo. Now, Rodrigo wasn't a great candidate for cardinalship. First of all, he was underage. He was not ordained as a priest. And he was known as a party animal. He threw wild parties, had multiple mistresses, lots of illegitimate children, things like that. And even after he was appointed cardinal, he continued doing this. Well, when Calixtus died, there were a few other popes, but eventually Rodrigo got into a position where in, let's see here, 1492, in a closely contested election, Rodrigo was elected pope. He took the name of Alexander VI, and was on the papal throne from 1492 to 1503. While he was a cardinal, Rodrigo had had a number of illegitimate children. Two of them are particularly important to us. One of them is Cesare, and the other is his daughter Lucrezia. Now, Cesare was appointed cardinal by Rodrigo once he became pope. Now, this was particularly difficult to justify because, number one, he was illegitimate, and illegitimate children were ineligible for priesthood. Secondly, he was underage. And he, again, sort of lacked the character that one would hope for in a candidate for cardinalship. But being pope means you never have to say you're sorry. So Rodrigo appointed him, gave him the dispensation, and put him in the position of cardinal. His daughter Lucrezia was married to a number of people over the years, good diplomatic marriages, but every one of them died in fairly short order after the marriage. Now, this is what gave Lucrezia Borgia the reputation for being a poisoner. The suspicion was she had actually killed off her husbands. Most scholars don't think that was likely. although I still find it curious when we go to, well, for example, in Madison, there was a coffee shop that had these fancy coffees, and one of them was called Cafe Borgia. I never had the nerve to try that one, knowing Lucrezia's reputation. But some scholars, and there's a certain amount of evidence that suggests that the husbands weren't actually killed by Lucrezia. They may have actually been murdered by Cesare. Because according to some period documents, there is at least the suggestion that he was, let's just put it, unusually close to his sister. This is the family that puts the fun in dysfunctional. Well, Alexander's goal was to take the Papal States, the Romagna, this patchwork of territories that the Pope nominally controlled, and he wanted to turn it into a Borgia family state, detach it from the papacy and put it in the hands of his family. He got the assistance of the French, got the French actually to invade Italy, and with their help, Cesare resigned as cardinal, led the papal armies with the help of the French, and conquered the Papal States to set up as a Borgia family territory. At this point, Alexander died. Cesare was violently ill at the time, so he was unable to really influence the papal election. An intermediate person was elected. He died fairly quickly, and then the great rival of the Borgia family, Giuliano della Rovere, was elected pope and took the name Julius II. Julius decided that he wanted to get the Papal States back, so he literally put on armor and led the papal armies in a war against Cesare Borgia. Julius won and arrested Cesare. Cesare broke out of prison and died while attempting a comeback. Apparently natural causes, he may have been murdered. Okay. That by itself should tell you everything you need to know about the Renaissance papacy. It was hopelessly corrupt, hopelessly mired in politics, and really about self-aggrandizement, very much the city of man, as Augustine would put it, rather than the city of God. So after Julius dies, Julius is on the throne from 1503 to 1513, he is succeeded by Leo X from the Medici family. Leo X will be the pope that is on the papal throne when Luther comes along. I will summarize Leo X by noting that when he was elected, he's reported to have said, God has given us the papacy, let us enjoy it. He was known for throwing banquets of 60 some odd courses, and now he'd inherited sort of a disastrous situation from Julius. The papacy wasn't in good financial shape. There was a major building project in St. Peter's Basilica going on, and then with his lifestyle, Leo is going to bankrupt the papacy. So that's the situation. Papacy is not in a position where they're really going to bother trying to take on the bishops. And in fact, what's going to happen more often than not is the papacy is going to indulge in a practice called simony, which is technically against canon law. Simony is the buying and selling of church offices. The way the papacy will get around that is they will allow people to be elected with their approval, but in order for them to take their office, they'll have to pay a fee. So the papacy is actually, for all practical purposes, selling the offices to the highest bidder. Again, this is not a situation that's going to encourage spiritual oversight. Well, every time the church has faced a crisis in its history, it went to the religious orders, these various groups that would emerge, really as reform movements. The religious orders, the Franciscans, the Dominicans, the Cistercians, all of these show up throughout church history for the specific purpose, really, of dealing with issues of corruption and solving problems in the church. So what about the religious orders in this period? What are they doing? Well, the fact is that they're not doing much. I mean, there are some, certainly, that are trying to live a faithful life, but the fact is that most of the monasteries had turned into country clubs for the nobility. It's a place for honorable retirement. In fact, well, the monks were in a situation, monks and nuns were in a situation where they were increasingly viewed as living immoral lifestyles, just like the parish priests were, and in particular for being alcoholics. The phrase emerged during this period of someone who drinks like a monk. It's the way you would describe someone who is an alcoholic. He drinks like a monk. It got so bad that there a new type of joke begins emerging in the 1400s into the 1500s. We have standard genre jokes. In America, there are a lot of lawyer jokes. If I start a joke saying, all right, there was this lawyer, if you're an American, you know generally where that joke is going to go. Okay. There are a whole series of these kinds of jokes. I imagine every culture has them. In this period, what emerged were cleric jokes. If I started saying to you, okay, I've got a great story for you. There's this monk, or there's this nun, or there's this priest. As soon as I started that way, you knew I was about to tell you a dirty joke. It's as simple as that. That's the degree to which the reputation of the clergy had sunk during this period. It is a massive, massive problem. The church was in crisis at every level and in every institution. Now, this doesn't mean that there weren't people who were serious. There were people who were trying to push through some form of church reform. There are local bishops, for example, who will get involved in this. So bishops will set up a situation where, you know, they'll come in, they want to clean up their diocese, and they'll send visitors around. They'll get a thing called visitation. They'll send people around where they'll go parish by parish by parish to examine what's going on. And these reform bishops who are really serious about what they're trying to do will discover parish after parish after parish where the local priests have their concubines. And they're upset about this because they're trying to enforce canon law. And they talk to the people of the parish and they'd say to them, okay, did you know that your priest is sleeping with this woman? And the answer, in the visitation records, the answer has come back pretty consistently. What do you think? We are stupid? Of course we know that. Okay, next question. Did you know that it was against canon law for him to be doing that? The response comes back. I repeat the question. Do you think we're stupid? Of course we knew that. Next question. Well, does it bother you? No, not particularly. Now, this got the visitors confused. Why? Why doesn't this bother you? The answer, what consistently in the visitation records, is, well, if he's got her, he's more likely to keep his hands off our wives and daughters, isn't he? Again, that is the extent to which the reputation of the clergy had sunk. Now, there were other people who were trying to push a reform program through. Now, bishops try at their best, but under these circumstances, and there are very few of them, but they are trying. Under these circumstances, there's only a limited amount they can move forward. There are other people, though, who are pushing a more systematic approach to church reform. Probably the best known of these is Desiderius Erasmus. Erasmus was the greatest humanist of the period. Now, when I use the word humanism here, I'm using it in the Renaissance sense of the word. A Renaissance humanist has nothing to do with modern humanism. The Renaissance humanists were people, the word humanista is an Italian word which means a student of the humanities. The Renaissance humanists were specialists in the humanities. This is a new form of education that emerges during the Renaissance. It emphasizes literary studies, it emphasizes rhetoric, it emphasizes a whole number of areas, very much like traditional modern approaches to studying historical texts. All these approaches really originated in the Renaissance. And Erasmus was very much aware of these. He was also very much part of the Renaissance tradition of wanting to look to the ancient past to find truth. The term Renaissance itself comes from the idea of a rebirth. What's it a rebirth of? It's a rebirth of the ancient world, ancient culture. In Erasmus's case, as a Christian humanist, he wanted to go back to the origins of the church, the early centuries of the church, the church fathers, and use them as a model for what the church should look like. So his great goal, his great emphasis in church reform is, first of all, to get the priests educated. He's a humanist. He's a scholar. He wants to see education put in its proper place to be a foundation for church reform. Secondly, he wanted to go to the model of the early church. He wanted to strip away all of the accretions that had developed in the church, that had encrusted the church over the Middle Ages, and get back to the purity and simplicity of the early church, of the patristic age. His great goal is to clean up the abuses in the church. He's essentially, like all humanists, Erasmus is practical. He's not interested in theology. He's not interested in speculative thought. What he wants to do is see the church cleaned up, go after the abuses and get those straightened out. He was, in fact, quite popular and very nearly successful. He had a number of people in the papal curia, the papal court that surrounded the Pope, the leaders. Many of these were trained humanists themselves. They saw what Erasmus was doing and liked it. And he very nearly succeeded in starting a fairly serious reform of the church. His approach got short-circuited, however, when a more radical approach to church reform, based not so much on practice but on theology, showed up, and that was the approach by Martin Luther. And we'll talk about Luther in the next section. The main thing, though, that you need to understand here is that no matter how bad the church situation was, the church was unassailable in the year 1500. Everybody knew where all the problems were, but it was unassailable because of one thing. It had a monopoly on a product everyone needed, and that product was salvation. Break that monopoly, and the church is in massive trouble. And that's precisely what